And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Jeremy Finley to the program today. Jeremy is an investigative reporter for a television station in Nashville, Tennessee. But today we're going to be talking about his debut novel, The Darkest Time of Night, which is the story of a woman desperately trying to find her abducted grandson without revealing to people the otherworldly culprits she believes to be responsible. Jeremy, the story begins with a young girl, Lynn Stanson, chafing at what seems to be like an arbitrary rule her father has. What is she not allowed to do?
She's not allowed to go into the woods. And there's a real reason why. She is told by her father and truly threatened by her father not to go in. And I think that we all have this romanticism about the woods and how often we love to go in it and kind of escape from the world. But there's also this sinister part to it that I think has always captivated readers and viewers of movies because of the unknown of what's in there. And in Nashville, where of course the book is set, is a very metropolitan area, but has these swaths of woods in neighborhoods. I used to live behind, right in the middle of downtown Nashville, and my house had this big forested area behind it. And we had a screened-in porch, and we could sit on the screened-in porch and listen to the crickets, and we'd have deer and all of this. And it was something to where there was just something magical about those woods. So I really wanted to encompass that in this book and bring the fear element to this. But Lynn's father is very clear from the beginning, you are never to go into these woods. And hopefully that sets the tone of what's to come.
Was there property in the city proper at the time, or did it get annexed in later?
So it got annexed in later. And in fact, that area of woods that I was just talking about, they wanted to develop it recently, and the neighborhood fought against it. And so the woods are still there. But where this book takes place is in an area called Belle Meade. And if you're unfamiliar with Nashville, that is where the biggest mansions and the biggest homes are. Al Gore has a home there. A lot of country music stars do. I did research into see what was Belle Meade was like before it was as it is today. And there are still areas of Belle Meade that have a pretty nice area of woods behind them. There's not many of them, but I wanted to kind of bring that element into this urban setting, which is the reality for, you know, some neighborhoods in Nashville.
Now, this part of the book is set almost 60 years ago. That's still, I mean, it seems like a long ways away, but it's like the 1950s.
Sure, right? It doesn't seem that long ago for me, but maybe it's because I have done so much research into this and wanted to bring the feel of what that was like. But Nashville is, especially in the last 10 years, has just had this incredible growth that has changed the city. But it's still very much an old Southern city, to where it has the mysteries and dark secrets and the things that make our Southern cities so great. There's still some neighborhoods that are exactly the same. So I think that was one thing that is great about Nashville, is there's all this growth and there's all this shine to it, but there's also this corrosion and darkness to the city that makes for great stories.
As her father has forbidden her from going out into the woods, she sees him going into the woods with a couple of strangers one night. She really didn't appreciate the double standard, did she?
She didn't. And that was something that I think as children we all grapple with, is when our parents tell us not to do something and then we maybe see them doing the same thing. But her decision will change her entire life, is what's revealed in the book. And she has to make that decision on that split moment. Well, Dad, we had this promise between us. You told me not to go in. You listed all the reasons to be afraid, listed all of the reasons why it's not safe for me to go in, but here you're going, and you're going with these strange men that are carrying lanterns in the middle of the day. And so she makes this decision that she's going to follow. And when she does, it gives her a scar of a memory that she can't escape. And she spends her entire adult life trying to escape. And that's really what sets the motion of this book, is that this is a woman who, this experience happened to her when she was extremely young, and she's in her 60s when the story begins, and she is trying to escape her memories. She's trying to escape what happened to her. As the novel goes along, finds she has to have a reckoning with that. But it is what happens in those woods with her father that is one of her permanent scars.
And she's a person who makes those decisions, and she has to make those decisions constantly during the course of the book, of, is this the prudent and safe thing to do, or is this the thing I need to do in order to resolve things?
So the book is obviously about the disappearance of her grandson and what she has to do to try to find him. And it is a scenario that so many of us agonize about. because we all have secrets and we all have parts of our lives that we have tried to escape from. And what comes in her moment of grief in the fact that her grandson has disappeared and no one can find him, she has to make that choice. Do I open up the wounds of my past in order to try to find him? Well, I think those of us that have had grandparents that are great people and love us dearly know that your grandparents will go an extreme long way to help the people they love. And that is her choice, is that she says, all right, I can't ignore anymore what happened to me, what I know, what I've done. In order to find her grandson, she's willing to take that risk, but it's a painful risk.
Her daughter and her family live close by.
Right.
And she still lives on the family property near these same woods
right.
from when she was young. Can you set the stage of the evening of what happened to her grandson, William, that night?
So a storm has blown through the city at this point. She's gone to bed and her parents have owned this property forever and she has told them never to go into the woods. But her daughter's husband allowed their grandchildren to go camping, except for the youngest grandson. The youngest grandson is upset that he wasn't allowed to go camping in the backyard. So he has stolen into the woods as an act of defiance that he's going to go and show his brothers. And she is awoken by a phone call saying, we can't find William, who is the grandson. They go into the woods, just the family at this point, she and her husband, her daughter, her husband, and the boys, and he cannot be found. And the only witness is William's older brother, who is young himself. And he's clearly in a state of shock. And all he will say is that the lights took him and then refuses to speak from that point on. And that begins this story of why won't this boy speak about what happened to his brother? And his brother has completely vanished. There is no trace of him. And this begins the journey for this family of what do you do in a circumstance like this?
Of course, a young child going missing from a very wealthy white neighborhood is going to get a lot of response from local law enforcement, but it's an overabundance of law enforcement response because Lynn's husband is a very important man.
He is. He is a U.S. senator that has just dropped the bomb on his family that he has accepted a vice presidential bid. This all coincides at the same time. And so this family, and Lynn in particular, is reeling with his decision to accept this post that will literally change their lives forever. And then at the same time, within 24 hours, their grandson goes missing. So there are a lot of questions that law enforcement have, that Lynn has, that the senator himself has. Is this tied together? Is this a way to derail my political career? Is this some kind of urban terrorism that I'm unaware of? So the stakes are risen because of that. But unfortunately, in my career as a journalist, I have seen and covered so many cases of missing children. And when that happens, and there's several in Nashville that are famous tragic cases of missing children, there is a huge amount of media interest quickly. And then when that goes on from years to years, they go away. But having done stories and knowing that the importance of that first 24 hours, 48 hours of finding this child, you know, the fact that a U.S. senator's grandson has gone missing and then can't be found after 48 hours makes it into a much bigger story that continues to hound this family.
I got my first hint that this book might be science fiction when you said there was a Democratic senator from Tennessee.
How about that, right? Doesn't happen very often. We have a few, but in terms of senatorial, no, but in Congress we do, but it's rare.
Another one of Lynn's daughters, Stella, works for a local television station, so she's media savvy, but Lynn has no desire to be part of the media coverage at all.
This is part of who Lynn is. She is very content by sitting on the sidelines. She has a very robust family of very outspoken children, a husband who is in the limelight. She is much more comfortable sitting onto the sidelines. So when this happens, it thrusts her into this very unexpected role of being out front, being asked to do interviews and having to do press conferences and this kind of thing. As you learn going through the book, is there's a reason that Lynn is not comfortable being the focus of attention. She has her own secrets. She realizes that there's a very good chance that what she's done back in the 1950s is going to come out if she begins to pursue this path of trying to find her grandson. So she's very uncomfortable in this world, and you learn pretty quickly why.
Now, you yourself are an investigative reporter for television news in Nashville.
Yes.
And I have to admire your restraint of not making your lead character in your book an investigative reporter who solves a crime.
That's, it would have been an easy way to do it. I know why reporters can be romantic characters and are great characters of fiction, because we're an interesting crowd of people. But when I wrote this book, I wanted to really tell a story of what I believe to be a population that does heroic things all of the time and doesn't get the limelight, and that's grandparents. I had great grandparents growing up that were just wonderful to me, and my own parents and in-laws have been great to my own children. And it was important to me that I explore that unexpected hero, because I think those are the great heroes of our times, are the ones that you don't expect or rise to a certain challenge that you don't think they could. I didn't want the hero to be the detective or the reporter or the government agent. There are great books written like that. I wanted to find the unexpected hero, and in this book, it certainly is Lynn.
You have a great quote from Hank Phillippe Ryan on the back. She's also a television reporter up in the Boston area.
She's great.
And the media gets its criticism
sure.
from both of you. How do your colleagues react when you say negative things about the media?
You know, I think that if you're going to work in the news media in 2018, you better have a thick skin. You better be able to handle the criticism. You know, some of it is warranted. Some of it is, I think, people not understanding how we work. I think that those of us that are in the media and the news media and then write fictionally about it, we can have a lot of fun with it because we know how it works. We want to be able to present it in a factual kind of way. I think we all get the jokes, and I think we all get the criticism. Like I said, you know, colleagues of mine who have been kind enough to read the book and write about it have said, you know, this is how it is. This is really, truly what we're, you know, dealing with in 2018. And, you know, what's interesting about this family is that they're a political family and they understand how the media works. Having a daughter that works as a reporter in this case helps them, but they understand they've got to use the media to try to get word out about where this missing child is. But at the same time, Lynn is very hesitant to have anything to do with it. As the book goes on, she has reason to be concerned.
We see that Lynn has her own life in Nashville. Her husband spends most of the week in D.C. taking care of the representation of the good people of Tennessee.
That's right.
All three divisions.
Right. That's right.
But she has a greenhouse business mm-hmm. in town, the Rose Peddler. Mm-hmm. Her best friend works with her, and Roxy is such a character.
She's a character. It's hard not to just put all the love on Roxy, because she's such the friend that we all wish that we could have, in the sense that she tells it like it is. Is unfailingly loyal, is brash, is
sassy and brassy.
Sassy and brassy and southern. And she was just a joy to write. And what I've taken so much pleasure out of is when people have come to talk about the book, they always ask about Roxy first. They always ask, oh, I loved Roxy. And I think that as a writer, that's one of the greatest compliments that you can get. But Roxy's essential to the story, because Lynn is in this moment of turmoil where she has to make these really difficult decisions, and she's not making them alone, because her best friend has said, I'm coming with you. Whether or not you like it or not, you may not like it, I'm coming. And she also sets what this is a, you know, speculative thriller, a science fiction thriller. Roxy is deeply rooted in reality. She is a skeptic. She's not buying what's going on, but she's fiercely loyal to Lynn, and it is their journey together to the unknown that hopefully, you know, keeps people very rooted in the real world as things start to go incredibly mysterious throughout the story.
And you talked about she invites herself because Lynn wants to go to the University of Illinois. She and Tom, her husband, the senator, were there back in the early 70s when he was in law school. And she had a relationship with a professor up there that she needs to reexamine and see if he can help her out.
I like to think in the 70s, as being a child of the 70s, that maybe things were a little more progressive maybe in the 70s. But when Lynn entered what she ended up doing at the University of Illinois, it was still very sexist. She needed to have a job because her husband was in law school. And she had a degree from Vanderbilt and wanted to be a novelist herself. But the job that was made available to her through some interesting means was as a secretary in an astronomy department. And that is where she begins to do research for one of the professors. I don't think it's a huge spoiler here to talk about that these are astronomy professors, and one of the professors is doing off the record, the university doesn't know kind of research into missing people. And it is Lynn's first exposure into what else might be out there. And she comes from a small rural area and opens her mind to these experiences of people all over the world that have these unexplained disappearances. And this professor opens her eyes to this and does more than just opens her eyes, but changes her life. And so the experiences from the University of Illinois both thrill and haunt her for the rest of her days.
This is independent investigations. This is not a governmental-led thing.
That's right.
This is not part of Project Blue Book.
There is nothing about this that there is any record of. And it's interesting. In doing the research for this book, I started looking into people that were in agencies, and I shouldn't say agencies because they're not government agencies, but they're organizations that truly started investigating missing people for supernatural reasons. They were active in the 50s and 60s and 70s and have been since. But in this story, she gets brought into this organization that is doing this research into unexplained disappearances of people. And no one knows about it, and there's a reason that nobody knows about it. She quickly finds out how much the government wants to know more about these disappearances and why they're so interested in this. But she learns the risks that come along with this pretty quickly. And this professor, you know, kind of enters her into this world. And once she's in, she realizes pretty quickly this is not just a part-time position. This is a mission that these people have taken on, and then she gets caught up in it as well.
In that time frame, we also learn that not only in the current day section, she has her own life, as her husband spends most of his time in D.C. When he was in law school, he was very much involved in his studies, and she had to make her own life even back then.
She did, and that was what I really wanted to get into with this character, is that she was a young woman, a new wife, and her husband that is pretty much out of her life, and they've just gotten married, and he's in law school, and he's trying to get through, and so she's got to really create this life for herself. And she has these ambitions of being a novelist, but when she starts getting involved in the research into these missing people, it gives her her first taste of purpose and excellence, and she is quickly elevated to a position of authority. And as a young woman in the late 1960s and early 70s, it really elevates her into a position of what is she going to be capable of doing in her life? And she gets a taste of that. And it's difficult to step back and say, okay, for the rest of your life, you're not going to accomplish much else. You get that first taste in your 20s. So she really, I think, gets that taste and is hard to give that up.
Because she did get her degree from Vanderbilt.
She did.
But at that time, the degree was usually MRS.
Absolutely. You know, she came from a very small area of Nashville to go to Vanderbilt to get that degree and then to do so well. You know, she has sights set for herself. So to go to watch her, you know, to really become a subservient person to her husband's career is stinging at first. And so then she gets that taste of being within the book itself, of being involved in an organization that starts really elevating her, gives her that taste of maybe I really do have something to contribute. That's what gives her the strength in those days to make a pretty daring decision, and then things go off the rails for Lynn.
Now, when she first gets up to the astronomy department at the University of Illinois, she gets along with most people, but there's one professor, Dr. Stephen Richards, who is not a people person in any way.
He is not. He is odd. He is young. He's not much older than Lynn. I think he's in his late 20s, and Lynn's in her early to mid-20s. But Dr. Stephen Richards has a lot to hide. There is a reason that he is as odd as he is and that he is as secretive as he is. And that really challenges Lynn, because she is able to work with these other professors who really appreciate her work. But there's something about this professor that he keeps her at arm's length. And then being who she is at this point in her life, she has enough. And she decides that she's going to hold this professor accountable for not paying attention to his students and not treating her with respect, and ends up in his office giving him a bit of a lecture. But when she makes that decision, she sees what he's doing. She sees the kind of research that he's doing. and it rattles her to her core of what he's doing. And he gives her a task, which is an almost impossible task, to kind of integrate her to see if she's up for this challenge. And she's able to do it. And when she's able to unravel this mystery that he has created just to test her, it opens his eyes to who she is and what she's capable of. And so they begin this relationship to where he has been completely guarded and begins to let her in, while at the same time she is a newlywed and trying to make her way within her own marriage, and creates this dynamic of how much can they trust each other? How willing are they both willing to go to try to find the truth about these missing people? And at the same time, their relationship begins to change. And so again, it rattles Lynn to her very core about what happens to her in those days.
But still, dealing with these people who are secretive and they're trying to find out something that it's not being discussed in a public way, you would think they might be more open-minded. But she has to battle sexism all along the way with this group of people as
well. She does. But even in those times, she is a young woman in a field of men. And any woman that has been in a field of men even today knows that there's a battle. And not only does she have to prove herself, but she is not an expert. But what she is smart, and she's analytical, and she has a great brain and a great education. And so she quickly figures out what these guys have been pursuing for a long time and reaches conclusions quicker than they can. So she's an anomaly to them. She is this Southern woman that is attractive and blonde and smart and educated and comes in and can figure out quicker than they can about what's going on. And especially for Stephen Richards, the professor, I think he is a bit dumbfounded of what to do with her, but then quickly realizes this is an asset that we've been waiting for a long time.
Now, what was it like for you writing across gender? Because a lot of men get tagged with, when they write women, they just put a man's brain into a woman's character.
Sure.
How do you avoid that trap?
So I heard a writer say this the other day, and I thought it was great, because a similar question was asked to a male writer. And his response was, you know, in my experience, women are people too. I think that's a thing to always, for writers to remember, that if you're going to write from a different gender, you better do your homework and you better study and you better pay attention to how women think and how their relationships are. I am lucky to be married to a great woman who I observe and watch and try to make as happy as I can, but also my mother-in-law and my mother. And I, when I realized I was going to write this story from that perspective, I made a conscious effort to watch them, to listen to how they spoke and what they did every day and how they interacted with their friends. And I made note of this. You know, for the first time in my life, I wasn't just having conversations with them, but I was truly studying them. And I think now they realize what I was doing and they kind of get a chuckle out of it. But I think to answer your question, ultimately it comes down to doing your homework. And if I'm going to make this authentic, then I better really understand what I'm writing from and what I'm writing about. And so I had to study these women and how they interacted. And it took a long time. There's a reason it took several years to write this book, because I had to get that right.
Being an investigative reporter, you are often doing research in order to find a narrative.
Right.
But now for this book, you're doing research in order to support a narrative. How was that different for you in the research phase?
I'll tell you, Stephen, it was a whole lot different, because as investigative reporters, I liken us to what prosecutors do before a trial. We're almost trying a case. We've got our facts and we know what we've got to do to prove what the facts show and what the truth ultimately is. And so we're following a breadcrumb, you know, is what we're following. And if you're a good investigative reporter, you look at all different angles and you look at what could be proven wrong about the facts that you have. In a literary standpoint, there isn't a trail of breadcrumbs to follow. You are going in every direction. You are looking for this story, what's going to be authentic, what's true. And so it was one of the great challenges of my professional life to be able to tell a story that is speculative, that is in the science fiction realm, but very much feels real. And that was what is so essential to what I wanted to do in this book, is that people would feel like that this could happen. It was a real challenge, and it continues to be a challenge in writing the sequel to this book, which comes out next year. How do you make this realistic? How do you make this feel like it could really happen while introducing these, you know, fantastical beliefs into it? So the path is not easy to follow. It can be a real challenge at times.
Well, I have to say, when the elements that are not of the world that we know come about in the book, they are restrained, that you don't give us more information than that you think the character would know, and that it still has this big feeling of unknownness about it, that you were able not to give us an info dump and explain too much for us.
So I liken back to what so many great directors of horror movies have said, to where they always wait to reveal the monster. They never show you the monster in the first scene, and then you never see the face of the monster. You just see a little bit of that monster, and you see a little bit of that monster, and you see a little bit of that monster throughout the film until the end, you see the monster. And when you do, you got that payoff. I liken that to what I do when I write books. So I don't want you to know what's going on right off the bat. I want you to feel comfortable in the world that we all live in. And then I'm going to give you a little bit of peace of something that, wait, that doesn't, what is this? What is this? What is this? And all of the great thriller writers, and there are so many greats out there, I think they do this. It's challenging in the speculative field. If you read anything by, you know, Stephen King or any of the greats in that, Anne Rice, it's a real challenge, because there are going to be some people that can dispend their belief and they can buy into it right off the bat. But I know as a new writer, I've got to find readers where they are right now. And I want them to feel like they're in a very real world, and kind of introduce as it goes along. But the short answer to what you're asking me is, it's important to me that there not be an info dump, that you're revealing a little bit as you go along. So when you do get to the ending, it all kind of makes sense and you can get that payoff, because you and I have both read books that we've loved, and then you get to the ending and you think, come on, really? So it was important to me to have an ending that could say, okay, this is what this has been about. This is why everything has been so secretive this whole time. It was important for me that it feel extremely real as it goes along, even when we're introducing the speculative elements.
I'm assuming the scenario came first and then Lynn came second.
You know, you're absolutely right. I was thinking about that on the way here, because I was listening to some of your interviews with other authors, is what came first, the character or the setting. And in my case, my mother-in-law inspired this story. She is very much like Lynn in the sense of that she has her own small business, but she's a very sweet, unassuming, very smart, but very comfortable being in the background of a very large family. And one night in the kitchen, we were talking about what she did while my father-in-law was in law school. And she had an experience where she worked as a secretary in an astronomy department. And she started talking about, she said, you know, and one of the weirdest encounters was I worked for this professor, and this professor did research into UFOs. And she's like, I would take these messages from all over the world, people calling in with these strange stories, and they were scared, and they firmly believed this. And she said, it was the strangest experience, touching these people's lives that I've never would have ever encountered before in my life. She took another job, and my father-in-law graduated, and they had their life. And I remember going to bed that night, just picking up my jaw off the floor, thinking, I had no idea my mother-in-law had this experience. And second of all, what a great book this could be. It was the inspiration of her experience that brought this book. And then, you know, the characters kind of came along with a ride.
Have you done any research into sleep paralysis and how a lot of people who claim to have been abducted may have been sleep paralysis?
Of course. And even to this day, there's so much scrutiny about any type of investigations or investigative agency or whatever into alien abduction or UFO abduction or abduction by something else, otherworldly. I read extensively about what could be the explanation for all of this. Is this, you know, some kind of psychosis? Are they simply making it up? Are they experiencing something that science can't explain? Is it literally just part of the brain that brings these images? What is it that makes this happen? And I think that's what's so fascinating about this topic, is there is no proof. There's slivers of proof. There is photographs of what may be this, or there's some government records that indicate, and there's people in power and that believe that this is real. But to this date, there's no concrete evidence. But this fascinates us as a society, because why does somebody in Africa and somebody in Little Rock, Arkansas describe an experience that is exactly the same? or very similar of an abduction or of a sighting. So especially as a journalist, we grapple with that. It's like, you can't really explain what this is. And there's so much scrutiny behind it that it makes it just ripe for thrillers and for movies. There's a reason that we're so fascinated by this, but it's because we simply don't have the answers.
In your field, I mean, and your reputation is such a big part of this. Now, granted, this is a novel,
sure,
but even dealing with a topic that is on the fringe like that, where
right,
you're worried about how it might affect your career.
You know, I have to be honest with you. I've been asked that by a number of very kind and very good reporters that have done reviews or pieces on the book. And they've asked me, you know, what do you believe?
I don't care what you believe. I want to know how it's affected your career.
That's affected your career, right? So I think people know. People are smart. And I think they know that, especially being an investigative reporter for 13 years and then a reporter since I was 17 years old, my whole world is rooted in fact. And there's nothing that I put in my journalism that has anything to do with fiction. We live in some troubled times. We live in some times of great anxiety. One of my ways of escaping is books and movies. So writing fiction for me is a way to suspend that part of my career and just have a way to escape and tell a great story. There's been no backlash. There's been nobody that I've shown up to do an interview to say, hey, you're the alien guy. So it's been okay.
Well, you say you want to escape from these anxieties, but in a lot of ways, books do address, you know, these fundamental questions,
sure,
and fears that we have.
Of course.
So which fears do you think were you addressing in yourself?
Absolutely.
In the course of the book?
So I've thought about this. So I have two daughters, and when you have children, you quickly realize that your whole world has changed. So there is no greater fear, I think, for a parent than to have a child disappear or something terrible to happen to them. And for me, that addresses this issue is, what if something happened to one of my girls and they just vanished and there was no explanation? So this is kind of a way for me to deal with that fear of what you would do. And so I wanted to tell a story. This is obviously a thriller. This is obviously a story of the, you know, government conspiracies and the kind of thing that many of us enjoy reading about thrillers. But it truly is about a family's love for each other and just how far they'll go for each other. And I wanted that rooted in this story so people could have a sense of comfort as this goes along, that there's a reason that they're going after this boy, that Lynn is doing everything she can to find him because it is the love for her grandson. And I've seen that in people who I've interviewed who have missing loved ones, especially for children. It never goes away. They never stop. So I'm dealing with a pretty big fear of mine in this book that I think, you know, all parents to a degree experience.
I have a pet theory that we do pay a lot of attention to child abductions, especially in the media, mm-hmm, nowadays. But you look at the statistics and abductions as a percentage of population have gone down greatly.
Absolutely.
Over the past 40, 50 years. And beyond just the media, the fact that it happens more infrequently makes it a bigger deal.
It makes it a bigger deal. That's right. And I think that's why we have a very famous missing persons case in Nashville of a young girl named Tabitha Tudors. And she has been gone ever since. I think it's been at least a decade now. And it's haunted the city because, like you said, you know, in so many cases, a child is found, reported missing, found quickly, and that's always such a big relief. But when a child isn't found or it's difficult to find that child, I think it does trigger something in us because of the – even though the rates of it have gone down, and thanks to technology, I think that they're hopefully easily found now. But it is the rarity of it. And when a circumstance like this, especially in this book where it would be a U.S. senator's grandson, elevates those stakes. And that's what makes a great thriller. When I read great thrillers, it is where the stakes just keep rising and they keep rising and they keep rising. And there's so much more at stake. And so that's what I tried to do with this book as much as possible, that I, you know, wanted to keep people thinking, okay, how in the world are they going to find this kid? What's going to happen? So that's what we tried to do.
With you having a very demanding job, having a family, all your familial obligations, where do you find the time to write?
So there's a reason I look as tired as I do all the time is because I get up at 5. I'm a 5 a.m. writer. I get up, I write for a couple hours, then get my girls ready for school and take them to school. And then I go to my job. And as a journalist, our jobs never truly end. You know, we're working all the time. And so then the next day begins. It's a 5 a.m. Luckily on Twitter, there is a group of us. Well, I have joined them. I'm of 5 a.m. writers. And you get on Twitter first thing and, you know, good morning, everybody. You know, hey, everybody's up. And it can be brutal. But the thing is I've wanted to be a novelist since I was in the fifth grade. I fell in love with journalism in college, and so that kind of took the place of that dream for a while. But when I was in my mid-30s, and especially my early 40s, I thought, okay, you know, if you're going to do this, stop talking about it. Let's get real. And I'm so happy to have this book out, and I'm so thrilled to be doing interviews with people like you, Stephen, and being able to talk about this, that getting up at 5 a.m. is worth it. It's such a joy to do. It's difficult. It drives you crazy. But if you're getting up at 5 a.m. to do something, then you better love it. And I do love this. And I, you know, hope that this is the first of many books to come.
If you were forced to make a choice, would you be able to?
Oh, Stephen, that's such a great question. I would say in the realistic world, I am not a superstitious person at all. I don't even believe in luck. That's the kind of person I am. Journalism has given me so many great ideas for books that I'd almost be afraid to part. And I will say this, and this is a romantic view of mine about journalism, is that I really feel it as a calling, especially investigative journalism like the work that I do, is that, you know, the money's never great. The hours are brutal. And the scrutiny is brutal. I feel like it's a public service. I have a friend of mine that's a firefighter, and he has his first book out, and he's always wanted to be a novelist, but he's a firefighter. And how do you stop being a firefighter when you're saving people's lives? Now, journalists aren't saving people's lives, but we are exposing corruption. And in the world that we live in, I think it's vital that that continues. So while it would be wonderful to think of, hey, I don't have to get up at 5 a.m. and I can write from 9 to 5 every day, would be great. I sure do love journalism. I sure do think it's important, and I can't let it go quite yet.
Now, I don't think we can talk about what the sequel might be like, because it would spoil too much of
sure.
The end of this book. But do you have a name for it yet?
I do. It is The Dark Above. Without giving away too much, what the characters at the end of this book are dealing with is what they encounter, what they find out to be the actual truth. And it raises questions about what's lurking beyond the stars. And when we were coming up with a title for it, I kept going through these thoughts of, okay, you know, what do I want for this title to be? And in working with the editor, we reached The Dark Above, because it is when we look up at the night sky and you see the vast darkness, there's something about it that either brings you great pleasure or makes you feel so insignificant, it's almost scary. The title is The Dark Above, and I'm thrilled for it to come out next year. I'm thrilled to say that a large chunk of it happens in Memphis, so I'm happy as a lark to be here and talk about that. I love the fact of being a Southern writer. This book is set in Nashville and then goes into other places, but very much in the sequel is Little Rock and Memphis and New Orleans and parts of Florida. I just think the South is so ripe with these great characters and these great settings. It really makes it a great place to be a writer because of the parts of our lives as Southerners where we just kind of wave our freak flag and embrace that. And it makes for great characters, is what it was such a joy to write this sequel because of I get to return to so many of these Southern towns.
I was just wondering real quick about the book is most likely going to be a thriller, but this book has been kind of mainly aimed at the mystery that has been revealed. You have to kind of have a different engine that's driving things.
Sure.
Since the mystery has been revealed to us.
That's right. It is. And you have to elevate the stakes and you have to elevate the game. To compare it to a television series, you watch, especially now, you know, we kind of binge watch these series and then the second season comes on. And if that second season doesn't elevate the stakes and make you question, whoa, you know, what's going on? That's what was so great about the television series Lost, is you watch the first season and there's so much you didn't get answered. And then the second season and it kept you guessing and going on and on. So that's the elevation of the sequel. And the sequel is a difficult thing to write because you have to elevate the stakes. You have to make sure that people are wanting to follow the story. So that was the ending of the book. While I hope satisfactory, does leave you questioning, oh, well, I want to know about this. Well, what happened with this? What happened with this? And I'm happy to say in the sequel addresses so much of that. But it is about elevating the stakes. And there's a whole lot more that these characters have to go through to truly understand about what's coming. Because at the end of this book, just gives you a glimpse of what's coming. And then the sequel unveils about what it is.
Do you think this will be set up as like a trilogy arc, or is the next book the conclusion?
So I will say, without giving away too many spoilers, is that I have loved writing these stories so much, I could see returning to them at some point. I loved writing the sequel. I love the continuation of these characters. I don't know the answer to B. These are characters that I would love to revisit at some point. But like most writers, I have about 15 novels that I'd like to write. But they will always be near and dear to me. And I'll always, you know, ultimately kind of think in my mind about what happened to them at the end. So we'll see. Maybe we haven't reached the end yet.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Stephen, it's been a lot of fun, and I would steal your voice as a broadcaster if I could. So if you can rent it to me from time to time, that would be great.
No dice.
You're keeping your voice.
Jeremy Finley is the author of The Darkest Time of Night, which is published by St. Martin's. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.